This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our Week in Review program. You know, there are a lot of programs out there that look back on the important news of the week, and I'm sure you're going to find some overlap between what you see in those other sources and the Trumpet Hour. But when we look at what we want to talk about, what to cover, we're not looking for high ratings. We're just trying to give you the most important news that we can find, what's happening in this world. If you're interested in really knowing the major trends and why they're significant, you are listening to the right show. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. We've got Richard Palmer via Skype from our UK office.
Hello.
We've got Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Robert the Morley.
Good to be here.
Our top story today is Europe being besieged by immigrants. 100,000 immigrants per month. The last 3 months have each set a record for the number of immigrants that are flooding into the continent. This is creating serious problems in countries throughout Europe. We're going to focus here on Germany in particular this week. The German Interior Minister said that Germany is expecting 800,000 refugees this year. He says Germany's taking in about 40% of all asylum seekers to Europe. Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung estimates it's going to cost Germany about 10 billion euros this year. Stephen Fleury's been talking about this on the Trumpet Daily. It's creating quite a lot of backlash throughout Europe. We're going to talk to Richard about this. First of all, Richard, can you give us an overview of some of the problems that this is creating within European nations?
Yes, certainly. So the most immediate problem is all of those countries kind of on the periphery of Europe, so Greece, Italy, and then even the Balkans, even though a lot of them are not part of the European Union, they're being flooded with the same stream of migrants coming into Europe. Then you start to get to Bulgaria and some of those other countries, and they're really being pushed beyond what they can cope with. So Greece last week on one of their islands was completely overwhelmed, and so the mayor had 2,000 immigrants essentially rounded up and locked up in the stadium without water and without toilet facilities for quite a long time. I think it was 16 hours. In Macedonia today, they declared a state of emergency. They had the police and the army on the border with stun grenades trying to drive off a crowd of 3,000 immigrants who were trying to rush the border there. Bulgaria, it's become quite a political issue. They're building a fence. But even on those countries then that aren't on the edges of Europe, it's becoming a big deal. So the biggest example of this is Sweden this week, where the anti-immigrant, some would say far right, I think that's too harsh a characteristic of them, but the anti-immigrant party became the largest party in their parliament, driven up by this backlash. And then even Britain, we've talked about on this radio show for the past few weeks, there's been the Calais crisis with migrants from France trying to come across the Channel Tunnel being blocked. And that's had major economic impacts to Britain. That's completely clogged up the roads in southern Britain. So it is a continent-wide problem.
Where are these people coming from? Why are they so intent on making their way to Europe?
For the vast majority, it's war. The biggest block of migrants is from Syria. And we all know about the terrible situation that's going on there. Afghanistan has another large group. Eritrea, and you've got a violent conflict there. Smaller in number, you've also got economic migrants, so people coming from North Africa, from maybe Nigeria, Mali, Algeria, Libya, though Libya I think probably be better to include in more the war part, the war category. But you've got economic migrants coming from North Africa who want the promise of a better life in Europe as well.
So how much of the backlash within these European nations is because of, say, ethnic and cultural differences, the ethnic and cultural makeup of these people that are flooding in and changing the demographics within Europe?
I think that's a good question. Ultimately, I think there's two separate ways that these migrants are pushing Europe into a political crisis. on the one hand, we've also got to remember what we've been talking about for the past couple of months, the euro crisis, huge unemployment in southern Europe. A lot of these places like Spain, you know, we look at that, tend to look at that as problem solved. You've still got 25% unemployment. And then you have these migrants coming in. And that's a whole load of extra money for the government to spend. But then there is that ethnic tension that you get at the best of times that's just made much worse by the financial crisis. And then you add in the fact that a lot of these migrants, most of these migrants are coming from the Middle East. They're Muslim. A lot of the ones from North Africa are also Muslim. And this adds another layer to what we're seeing. And remember, Europe and a lot of Europe's big cities already have huge Muslim populations. Marseille, Barcelona, Brussels, all these famous European cities, even before this migrant crisis, are one-third Muslim.
That's amazing. Now, so there is the economic component, but there is also just this this desire for Europeans, or recognition that we're already becoming overrun with a culture, a religion that is contrary to sort of the historic heart of what makes us European, that's creating this tension.
Right, that definitely that historic heart, but also the more modern secularist Europe. Muslims are, or tend to be, much more devout and much more open in their display of their religions. And so we're already seeing a lot of clashes where European countries are banning the veil and the burqa and all these outward displays of religion. And in Switzerland, they've had a lot of tension over minarets on mosques and domes. So that is another area of tension there. And then the big thing that you throw in, of course, that is Islamic terrorism and Islamic extremism. There you've got a very, not kind of a hypothetical threat to a way of life or a culture, but a very real and a very physical threat to people's lives. And the problem here is, you know, Europe doesn't, and again, whenever we come back to this, I tend to go back to Friedman's book, Flashpoints, because he just articulates this really well. Those doing the policing in Europe, they can't tell the difference between a moderate Muslim, between a Muslim who, say, is really into their religion but would never blow anyone up, and an extremist. And there's no, you know, the Muslim community, there's no sign of them, I don't know, handcuffing extremists and marching them to police stations. So eventually what this is going to lead to is some kind of stigmatization of all Muslims. And you combine all of these factors, the economic, the cultural, and then the terrorism, and you have a very potent crisis brewing.
Let's look at Germany in particular. What kind of political pressure does this create? When you have Germans looking at this, you have the interior minister bringing these numbers out and saying, look, we're bearing an outsized share of the burden in trying to accommodate this flood of immigrants. What's happening there in terms of the populace and the political pressure that's creating?
They've probably got more pressure than any other European country. And it's not just the Muslims and the immigrants that are there. They also had the Gastarbeiter program in the post-year wars, where they had a lot of Muslims come in from Turkey, and a lot of them and their children are still there. And for the most part, since, you know, Germany has this heritage and this war guilt from World War II, and that has made your average German much more reticent to criticize immigration and to criticize these different cultures than many other European countries. But we're losing that now just because they're being overwhelmed by so many migrants. And it's easy to sympathize with that, but there's a lot more rise in extremist attacks now, rise in people attacking or threatening asylum seekers, graffiti outside asylum centers, and then it becomes... you have local areas refusing to take on any more migrants. But the numbers are just so high that you are going to have these tensions.
What's interesting to me in looking at this, we're looking at the immigration crisis in Europe, and we obviously have somewhat similar situation in the United States with a tremendous amount of pressure on the country culturally and economically because of the immigrants that are coming in. It's a huge political topic here. for us at the Trumpet, we're looking at this, a similar situation in both arenas, but looking at it in two very different ways. In the United States, we're looking at it more from the standpoint of how it's weakening the country and precipitating, say, unrest within our cities that could explode into a much greater problem over time. Whereas in Europe, we're really looking at it as the inevitable escalation of a conflict between two powers, between it's essentially what is provoking Europe into taking more radical measures in order to stop this from happening. So we're looking at this from a prophetic perspective. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that in terms of the bigger picture of why this is important.
Right. Well, really, we're looking, like you pointed out, we're looking at the two opposite ends of the extreme, I guess, in how to deal with this kind of a crisis. America is taking the do-nothing approach. But you look at Europe's history, where they have a repeated history of incredibly violent crackdowns on people that are classed as other. I mean, look at some countries in Europe, Jews have been outlawed for hundreds and hundreds of years. In some places in Europe, almost a millennia. And so you have a very long and a very repeated history of a violent crackdown. So what's coming in Europe, we know from history and prophecy, is the opposite of what's coming from America. This time in Europe, it'd be more of a repeat of the, well, I don't know whether it'd go as far as the gas chambers. We don't know all the details. And we do know that Europe is going to ally itself with some Muslim countries. But it will result in a much more authoritarian Europe than we see today. And it will be part of the crisis that pushes Europe into that authoritarianism and that harsh government.
Yeah, when we're looking at the prophecies and the way that they're going to unfold within Europe, we just see all of these pressures, what's happening in the world from Russia and the dangers that are increasing in the in Asia, and this migrant crisis and the increase in terrorism and the rise of Iran and the economic pressures within Europe. And we see this confluence of factors that are driving Europe to have to respond by getting stronger at some point. So it will be really interesting to see how this immigrant crisis plays out and how Europe responds to it. I think any time you start hearing politicians talking about how it's important that we need to deal with this more forcibly, that we can't allow this to overrun our shores, that we have to be much more robust in our response, it kind of sends chills up your spine if you know what's going to be happening in Europe in the longer term. While we're in Europe, we'll stay there, Richard. If you could give us some of the other headlines that you felt were important out of Europe this week.
Yeah, well, the big news today was that the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, resigned. And I don't think it was a huge surprise. A lot of people were anticipating that he would do this after getting all the bailout agreement through. What it does mean now is there's the potential for more instability within Greece, potential for the rise of more extreme parties. Since he has cooperated with Europe, the more extreme elements of his party have split off and formed another party that is even more left-wing and even more against the bailout. And so we're just continuing to see political dysfunction and political fracture in Greece. And then the other thing I'll mention is that the Pope held up a sign calling for negotiation over the Falklands and using the Argentinian name for the Falklands, Las Malvinas. And this very anti-British sign, you know, the Catholic Church and the Catholic press organization has said the Pope didn't know what he was doing. He didn't realize what he was holding up. The person who gave the sign said that it's not true, said that the Pope volunteered and was quite happy to hold this up. But even if you go back to the Falklands War, the Catholic Church was very much against Britain and was calling for Britain to stop fighting then. So
it's not too inconsistent with what we've seen in the past from the Vatican.
Exactly.
And your top story this week from Europe, apart from the one that we've already discussed, there was another bit of exciting news.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about an article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly about Andrzej Duda, the new Polish president. And what's very interesting here about the new Polish president is we've seen a political shift on the right wing in Poland. And it's got big international ramifications. We don't usually stop to talk about internal Polish politics, but this is important. So broadly speaking, in Poland, you've got the liberals and you've got the conservatives. The liberals tend to be a little less anti-Russian. You know, Poland has been abused by Russia so many times in its history, you're not going to get a pro-Russian party. And the liberals are also more pro-EU and more pro-Germany.
They like then everybody. You've got,
sorry?
The liberals like everybody.
Exactly. And then you've got the conservatives. And this is the party and this is the wing that Duda is from. And they typically are very hawkish on Russia. But also they've typically been very Eurosceptic and pretty anti-German. So, for example, one of the previous conservative leaders, Jarosław Kaczyński, he said that Merkel belongs to a generation of German politicians who would like to reinstate Germany's imperial power. And they've been very strong in condemning Germany and German influence in Europe and Germany having too much power in Europe. But with Duda, with this new president, we see a big change here. He's from the conservative wing, like the rest of the conservative wing. He's very Catholic. And he is very hawkish on Russia. And this article talks a lot about his efforts to unite a lot of Eastern Europe into an anti-Russian alliance. But he's made a big shift when it comes to his party's position on Germany. He is actually very pro-German. He's trying to say that his priority would be to overcome German resistance to an expanded NATO ground presence in the region. His second overseas destination was Berlin. He's trying to persuade Germany to send more soldiers into Poland. So now you have a broad consensus between the liberals and the conservatives on the most important parts of Polish foreign policy. The liberals have become more hawkish on Russia since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the conservatives and the liberals both agree now that Poland needs to look to Germany and trust in Germany a lot more. So we'll see. In recent years, Poland, under a liberal administration, has lent a lot on Germany. And we've talked about that on this show, about how much they've trusted in the German military and want to draw closer to the German military. This shift means that no matter what happens in Polish politics, if we see a shift in an election to the Conservative Party, this pro-Germanism and this policy of seeking a military alliance with Germany will continue.
Very significant. Thank you for that. Definitely something that we'll have to keep our eyes on, I think, especially in light of what we were talking about with the alignment of military cooperation between these two countries and among other European countries, and how much Germany has involved itself and really taking more of a leadership position among these militaries in these other countries. It'll be interesting to see how that proceeds under this new Polish president. Thank you, Richard, for that story. We're going to turn now to the Middle East. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program, and we've been talking about Europe. We're going to turn now to Brent Noctegal, who keeps his eye on, well, what, the most volatile region in the world. Brent, can you give us the overview of stories from the Middle East?
Yeah, there's always a lot happening in the Middle East, and this week was no different. Just today, the Turkish president, Erdogan, he announced snap elections would take place November 1st. You'll remember earlier this year, his ruling party suffered a pretty big loss, or at least they lost the majority. So in the meantime, the past 45 days, they've been trying to form a government, but obviously none of the governments would work because they wouldn't have a majority. So he's decided, as all dictators do, that we're going to have another election and see if we come off a little bit better. So they would have a ruling majority there. So that's one story. Another story relates to the UK. United Kingdom is opening their embassy up in Tehran this weekend. You're going to have the foreign secretary probably attend that opening in Tehran. And at the same time, just today as well, in a mosque, that one of the leaders of the military, the Iranian military in Tehran, they added not just death to America, not just death to Israel, but they actually added death to England. as well to their slogan. So they were chanting that the very weekend that the embassy's about to open. And you'll remember 4 years ago, the reason the embassy closed was that it was overrun by militants or hardliners in Iran. So UK is going back, and it looks like a lot of the people aren't happy about it. I don't know how much of a welcoming they're going to get.
I wonder what Iran would have to do in order to convince outsiders that this might not be such a great nation to do business with. Can you tell us what the top story that you felt came out of the Middle East this week?
Well, the top story I want to talk about, it does relate to what Richard was talking about earlier with this immigration crisis that's taking place in Europe. And one of the countries he mentioned there is Syria. That's where the majority of these people are coming from. And it's not going to end what we see, because I think there's a little over 4 million refugees from Syria that are currently being housed in neighboring countries. Turkey has 1.5 million Syrians. Jordan has over 500,000 Syrians. And the little nation of Lebanon, which has a population of 4 million, has 1 million Syrians there, just burdening down its already floundering country. And inside Syria, up to this point, there's still 8.5 million people that aren't living at home. They're displaced. So you know that a lot of them are still going to come and try and cross those borders into those countries, eventually end up in Europe. But the top story mainly concerns what's going on in Lebanon. Now, up until this point, the Syrian government or the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad has lost power over all of his border regions or border crossings with neighboring countries, including Iraq, Jordan, and Turkey. But they have maintained control of all of the borders going into the little nation of Lebanon. That changed this week. ISIS, the Islamic State, they attacked the border region that connects the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, the main valley that runs up the eastern side of Lebanon to Syria, and the main one of the big Syrian cities of Homs. This territory has been controlled by the Syrian regime and its supporter in Lebanon, Hezbollah. They've both been trying to make sure that this area between Homs and Lebanon remains open so that they can ensure that Hezbollah receives the arms it needs to fight its own war. And it's just incredibly critical for Damascus or Iran through Damascus to have access to the Mediterranean Sea, and that runs through this region of Homs as well. So you had ISIS actually going to try and take out this border and maintain control of Hezbollah. Now, there have been reports saying that Hezbollah might have lost it for a bit, then gained it back. But it indicates a trend that is worrisome for a lot of people. This Syrian civil war, ISIS, and all the people fighting, they haven't reached Lebanon yet. Lebanon has had its own problems for the past 30 years, but ISIS hasn't got there yet. Now, ISIS is starting to knock on the door of Lebanon, and that's a big worry for the populace there. The government inside Lebanon hasn't been functioning for a number of years. They've been in this kind of state of trying to find who's going to be the president or not, and the interim government's been in there just a long time. The function of the government's been shutting down. The trash hasn't picked up in Beirut for a month. It's just things like this. They are in no way ready to deal with the influx of ISIS into that country. Now, as I said before, there's already 1 million Syrian refugees inside Lebanon, and that poses a big problem. Whether they will, you know, what they are going to do in the event that ISIS does cross the border. But the big reason that we're watching for this is that we fully expect Lebanon to be involved in this Syrian crisis, and maybe ISIS is opening the door for this.
So what is Hezbollah's response? You know, they've been such a huge power broker there in Lebanon. And for them to have this threat coming in from the outside, first of all, the instability that would be caused by the Syrian refugee crisis, but then this other radical player within the region knocking on the door, what's their response?
Well, Hezbollah's response is always governed by what Iran wants, and Iran's greater goals determines what Hezbollah is going to do. Right now, Hezbollah and Iran, they actually are in a bad way in northern Lebanon and southern Syria, right at this border. There's been a lot of political negotiation that's been taking place over the past couple of weeks to try and organize a truce in the Syrian war, and that's been led by Iran. Iran's happy to give away 80% of Syria at this point and maintain control of this region from northern Iraq through Damascus, through the city of Homs, all the way to the Mediterranean coast. They'll settle for that. But right now you have ISIS attacking that. So Hezbollah is doing all it can to leave Lebanon and actually fight in the Syrian territory to make sure that doesn't happen. But the fight is coming home, and this is bad for Lebanon. Lebanon's demographics are different to any other Middle Eastern country. Lebanon is majority of the ethnicities, or religions, sorry, are Christian. Not the majority of the populace, but the greatest minority are Christian. 40% of Lebanon is Christian. 35%, something like that, or 30% is Shiite, led by Hezbollah, and 30% is Sunni. So you've got a more volatile mix. And if ISIS is going to try and take away, they're going to come into Lebanon, they're going to be fighting Hezbollah first and foremost. And that's what, you know, we're looking for, Hezbollah to act, their power actually to diminish in Lebanon. Earlier last year, Mr. Flurry, the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet magazine, he came out and said that we expect a civil war to erupt. We expect this crisis in Syria to erupt in Lebanon because we know that these demographics are going to motivate other powers to come into play here. I mean, the Islamic State, they're already going around to houses inside Syria, putting a big N on Christian houses, N for Nazarene, Christ of Nazareth. So once they get into Lebanon, 40% of that population is going to come under threat. And Hezbollah, they might try and stop and protect the Christian people there, but you might see other Christian powers that are willing to act in Lebanon where they weren't willing to act in Syria.
What is it that is informing the long-term prognosis that we're expecting for Lebanon, prophetically speaking?
Right. Again, this gets back to the prophecy we've talked quite a lot about of the two alliances that are going to form in the Middle East with Arab and Middle Eastern nations. And one of those does include Lebanon, and that is that Psalm 83 alliance that will eventually align itself with a German-led Europe. Now, Lebanon, we've noted, has been taken over by Hezbollah pretty seriously. Nothing happens in Lebanon that Hezbollah doesn't okay. But we're calling for that to flip-flop. We're calling for that to stop, for Hezbollah's power to diminish in Lebanon. Nobody else is saying that, but Mr. Flurry was able to make that call from what he sees in the Bible, where you've got the ancient nations of Gebal and Taman, I think. Well, Gebal was definitely one of the mentioned in Psalm 83, and that's this territory of Lebanon. So we know that they are going to side with Germany eventually. And that's why we're so interested in watching what takes place in Lebanon, because we're expecting Hezbollah's power to diminish.
It's not the easiest situation to discern exactly what way this is going to go. There's just a whole lot of factors that are at play. There's a lot of instability that could break any number of ways, but we're looking at, say, an ultimate outcome and trying to discern how it is that present circumstances would lead to that outcome.
Exactly. I think, you know, we don't know for sure that Hezbollah is going to diminish in power, and that the Sunni powers, the Christian powers, will rise up against Hezbollah.
Well, it's interesting, even when you're looking at, say, the way that we're seeing this breakage between the Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Iran, which this was an alliance that seemed unbreakable in the past. Is it possible that there might be some kind of a fracturing in that alliance, even between Iran and Hezbollah?
That is very possible. And even as time's gone on over the past couple of years, I've been watching this, I'm kind of getting to the point that while Hezbollah necessarily might not flip to not support Iran, they might be run out of town by their own supporters in Lebanon. You might see the Shiites actually realize, I don't have any of my sons, or I had four of them and now I've got one, because three of them went to fight for Hezbollah, for Iran in Syria. And I don't like that. I care about my family more than I do Iran and more than I do Hezbollah. So you might see that populace that has been lending support to Hezbollah flip-flop.
Interesting to watch. We'll have to keep our eyes on this very volatile region. These stories that we're talking about, they're in this week's Trumpet Weekly, the article that Brent was referencing. It's an Arutz Sheva article called Islamic State is Heading for Lebanon Next. This Trumpet Weekly is a very informative report that we produce each week. We try to bring together the most significant stories from our own reporting and from news sources all over the place, the best commentary that we can find. And we want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you go online to thetrumpet.com, you can become a subscriber and receive this report in your email inbox every week. Coming up next, we'll have news from Asia and America. Later on in the program, we'll have our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We're going to turn our attention now to Asia. We'll talk to our Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques. Can you give us the overview of important stories this week?
Yes, Russia and Iran seem to be rapidly forging closer ties in the aftermath of the Iranian nuclear agreement that was reached in July. Ties between Moscow and Tehran have been warming for several years, but now they just seem to be jumping into quantum speed. On Monday of this week, the foreign ministers of the two nations met, and now Russia is saying that by the end of this year, it'll deliver its advanced S-300 surface-to-air missile system to Iran. So this really just shows an axis forming whose common ground is anti-Americanism. And then this week, just yesterday, actually, the Chinese and Russian navies launched into their largest ever joint exercises. We've talked about this when it was first announced, but now it's happening. And this just shows these two powerhouse nations really coming together in a way that is unprecedented and of great geopolitical and prophetic significance.
All right. And the big story out of Asia this week?
That is that China may have developed an active phased array radar 6 years ago that performs to the same level as radars used by American F-22 fighters. That's the view of a report in the Trumpet Weekly that was published just yesterday in the Want China Times. And this report says that the radar is a revolutionary piece of technology because it can electronically jam just about anything. It can neutralize the majority of in-service radar-controlled air-to-air missiles. So basically, it makes stealth jets extremely difficult to detect by just about any enemy aircraft. This story is significant because it fits into a trend that we've seen in recent years of China and Russia really catching up to certain advanced American military technologies in a way that would have seemed unimaginable just a few years ago. I'd like to read a quote here from a pivotal report that was published recently by Langley's intelligence agency. The report is called U.S. Military Cuts Seed Tech Edge to Russia and China. And it says, shortfalls in U.S. defense spending will ripple across all branches of the armed services. What is less obvious are the effects of spending cuts on the military's ability to maintain its technological edge. So this technological edge is something that has long given U.S. forces battlefield superiority. It includes things like robotics, next-generation navigation systems, really advanced reconnaissance systems, and things like this incredibly sophisticated electronic jammer that that the Want China Times is talking about this week. And it is true that America spends 2.5 times more on its military than Russia and China combined. So ultimately, America's problem is less about spending too little and more about just trying to maintain a technological edge. It's more about a lack of vision regarding how to just keep on being leagues ahead of these other nations.
The question comes to my mind, how do you have any idea of how much this leap forward in technology that China has made is a result of espionage or theft of technology from the United States?
There have not been conclusive reports about that, but I would imagine that is a huge part of it. It's incredibly hard work to be the world's leading military power. You have to expend all kinds of effort to constantly innovate, to constantly develop new technologies that your enemies will not expect. You have to work toward these kind of developments, and it's work that requires lots and lots of money to go into projects that ultimately come to nothing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of trial and error, a lot of floundering, and the effort and the waste is exhausting the U.S. military machine. But for Russia and China, these kind of nations that are just sort of trying to play technology catch-up, all they have to do is copy technologies that have already proven effective. And as you mentioned, there's lots of cyber espionage. We talk about those reports happening all the time, and I believe that's a huge component of this. So it's far easier, far less expensive for a nation like China to just try to catch up and to try to steal a few trade secrets, mimic it with their own technology, than it is for the U.S. to constantly be innovating.
Any idea on, say, what the practical ramifications of China having this technology would be? Or can you help us to understand, say, the why this would be such a valuable tool for them?
Well, this particular radar, it's a jammer, essentially. And from what I can tell, it just makes it extremely difficult for their jets to be detected. So it's an electronic jamming device. What it means is that Chinese craft could fly with the same degree of stealth, the same degree of invisibility that America has enjoyed. And for many years, we felt that we may have kind of had a market on that. We alone were invisible in the skies. But now it may well be that China is just as well cloaked as we are.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. We'll turn now to Anglo-America and to Robert. Can you give us the overview? Quite a lot of big headlines coming out of the English-speaking world this week, Robert.
Yes, there was. The White House this week, in particular, it announced on Tuesday the appointment of its first openly transgender staff member. It was hailed as a step towards the White House's goal of appointing more gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender people to leadership positions. Rafi Friedman Gerspan is the new outreach and recruitment director for presidential personnel in the Office of Personnel. So as such, it's his new job to make sure that the White House brings in more LGBT members into the White House. In other news, a former abortion technician who has become a whistleblower is accusing Planned Parenthood of some terrible crimes. I apologize about the graphic nature of this, but in the latest video released by the Center of Medical Progress, Holly O'Donnell, she's a whistleblower. She describes how STEM Express, this company that was working with Planned Parenthood, would harvest organs. And she describes this incident that led her to quit her job and become this whistleblower. In this video, she was holding a baby that looked very close to being fully formed, a very late-term abortion. And a Planned Parenthood technician went ahead and even restarted the baby's heart to keep the organs more fresh. And as this baby's heart is pumping, they go ahead and use a saw to cut through the baby's head and take out his brain so that the brain would be more fresh. And despite these gruesome stories that continue to come out, President Obama in particular has continued to promise to veto any attempts to take away funding at the federal level. A lot of other stories this week, but you need to go to the Trumpet Weekly and check those out.
What just real quick, what are some of the headlines that people can see there?
Well, there's stories about our border, for instance. In the month of July, there was 135 unaccompanied children that were minors that were caught illegally crossing. At that rate, we're expecting about 50,000 minors to enter the United States. That's just the minors. Then there's also their families, which are coming across at a much higher rate, which will put the illegal immigrants into the hundreds of thousands per year.
All right. Well, go ahead and give us your top story. This is actually the top story up on the website today, thetrumpet.com. It's also the front page story on this week's Trumpet Weekly. Not directly about America, but major implications for America. It's an economic story. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. currency wars appear to be breaking out around the world, and commentators are starting to compare the conditions that they're seeing today to those in the 1920s and 30s in the lead up to World War II. You probably heard that on August 11th, China surprised the world by announcing and initiating the greatest single-day devaluation of the yuan in China's history. And then that was just, as it turned out, the warning shot. Over the next few days, the yuan fell at an unprecedented rate, blowing through multi-decade records for depreciation. Over the course of just a couple of hours, China's products became 2% cheaper than their rivals in America. Over the course of the week, they're now around 5% cheaper than they were just a few days before. And the question is, if this trend continues, what will happen to manufacturing, manufacturers, exporters in the United States and around the world? As you can imagine, this has evoked loud response from much of the world. Kazakhstan, Vietnam, for example, they announced that they would immediately devalue their currencies. India didn't even announce it. They just started devaluing their rupee. Turkey let its lira slide. Other nations, Australia, South Korea, Canada, nations that don't typically intervene in their currencies, they saw their currencies slide. So, for example, the U.S. ambassador to China, John Huntsman, actually he's a former ambassador, he told CNN that people were, quote, very, very frustrated with this deliberate policy of devaluation. So this is the impression that the world has on what China is doing. And the outrage was so loud that China's central bank chief actually had to come out and address this. And he made a statement. And China's central bank is usually very tight-lipped about what they're doing. But he actually came out and he said that the government had, quote, no intention or need to participate in a currency war. End quote. And then he went on to call the commentary to the contrary, quote, completely groundless and unfounded, end quote. And it did nothing to soothe the world's reaction.
Yeah, I mean, he can say what he wants, but just the reality of what's happening here is people, this is currency war, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is currency war. It's today, right now, China is being called the kamikaze, but I think, or the financial kamikaze with what they're doing because of the reaction it's causing around the world. But the reality is that this currency war has been ongoing for some time. This is just the latest broadside in currency wars. A good case can be made that the United States actually started this in 2008 after Wall Street melted down. What did the Federal Reserve do? It went out, it slashed interest rates to zero. It started firing up the quantitative easing cannons and depreciating the dollar to stimulate the economy. And it wasn't long. Every central bank in the world is doing the same thing. Today, the Europeans, the Bank of England, they're all quantitative easing, trying to drive down their currencies and steal trade. And now commentators are saying, this is very, very dangerous. This is getting extremely dangerous. And we know this not only from what's happening today with trade deals starting to become more unilateral or bilateral between countries instead of big overarching deals that include the whole world. We're seeing more of a trend towards the protectionism that we saw in the 1920s and 1930s, which was a result of the currency devaluations that happened then. We can look how back in the 1930s, people probably remember how President Roosevelt, he made it illegal for U.S. citizens to own gold, and then he devalued the dollar against gold. And that was just one step. The Brits did it. The French did it. The Austrians did it. I mean, the Germans, the Italians back in that time, they destroyed their currencies trying to gain competitive advantage to keep their industries going, employment high, keep their economies moving along and people employed, to keep the destructive social forces at bay. And now we're wondering, are we in the same situation once again?
These measures to use currency as you look at, say, individual policy decisions with respect to within the nation on its own currency, it seems like it's a survival mechanism. What are the bigger implications, and why currency war, which the average person says currency war, what's the big deal? It doesn't shoot anybody up with bullets. How that leads to World War II, how it leads to World War III.
Right, absolutely. So currency wars, depreciating currencies, is an effect an attempt to steal trade from other nations is what it is. You drive down your currency to try to gain market share at the expense of your neighbors. Commentators call it beggar your neighbor policy. This is an attempt to enrich yourself against somebody else. And the reason this is happening right now, and this is a point, is because the world is starting to shrink. Global economy is not growing. So nations are trying to steal an ever greater share of a shrinking global economy. And when you put that in context of a world whose debt levels are skyrocketing, you can see the imperative. These businesses, these corporations that influence governance need more trade. They need more business to pay the debts. Governments need more revenue to pay the debts. And they're balancing that, the need to pay their debts and keep functioning, to keep the welfare going, to keep the social programs in their countries functioning at the level that they see as needed, versus setting off international incidents around the world.
Thank you very much, Robert. This article is called Dangerous Currency War Dragging World Toward World War III. It's the top story today on thetrumpet.com. It's the front page story of this week's Trumpet Weekly. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can receive this free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we're talking about in the program today is in this edition of The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to finish up the program next with our lightning round of news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll begin with Brent.
This story relates to an AP report that came out this week that looks over one of the secret side deals that was arranged in the Iranian nuclear agreement between Iran and the IAEA. And it says that at the military site of Parchin, the Iranians will be the ones collecting their samples there and then turning them over to the IAEA. So it's not the IAEA inspectors that'll get to go there on the ground and pick their samples from whenever they want to see if they've conducted nuclear activities. Iran is actually giving those samples over. This editorial from the Wall Street Journal says that, in other words, the country that lied for years about its nuclear weapons program will now be trusted to come clean about those lies, and trusted to such a degree it can limit its self-inspections so they don't raise military concerns in Iran. It continues to say, why not cut out the IAE middleman and simply let Qassem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force, sign a personal affidavit that they didn't engage in nuclear work? So this nuclear deal is becoming worse and worse as time goes on.
Amazing. We'll turn now to Richard.
I'd like to talk about Greek airports. When Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras came to power back at the beginning of the year, one of the biggest things Greeks disliked about the bailout deals they were forced to live under was the fact that the government was forced to sell off Greek assets to foreign companies. Well, the sale is now back on. Under the new bailout deal, Greece has to sell off more companies and assets, and it has started with 14 regional airports, and they've all been sold to, or the rights to operate at 14 regional airports has been sold to a German company. So privatizations are back on, and Germany is the first benefit of this.
As we expected, we'll turn now to Jeremiah.
Tensions around the 38th parallel seem to really be heating up again. It started 2 weeks ago when North Korea illegally planted some landmines in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. Well, the mines exploded and severely injured two South Korean soldiers, and the South reacted by using psychological warfare. They turned on a set of loudspeakers that blast a message into North Korea that is basically just a scathing criticism of the government. And these are insanely loud speakers that mostly target the soldiers there in North Korea, but they reach 12 miles in, the sound does, so it also targets some civilians. North Koreans fired some shots at those speakers. They missed, but the South still fired back. And now the North is threatening war and moving missiles around. And President Kim Jong-un has said that South Korea has until 5 p.m. on Saturday to unplug those speakers, and then he'll invade. So there's a tendency among some of the armchair generals on the internet to sort of laugh at this. Here goes Kim Jong-un, saber-rattling again. And maybe these tensions will come to nothing, as often happens with the Koreas. But I don't think that's a laughing matter, because Kim Jong-un is not a rational actor. So it's hard to say what'll happen.
Thanks very much. And on to Robert.
Psychologists have confirmed, finally, that playing violent video games is linked to aggressive and callous behavior. A review of almost a decade of studies found that exposure to violent video games was a risk factor for increased aggression. Surprise, surprise. This is something that we've been warning families about for years and years, that you can't constantly be putting violent graphic images in your mind and not be affected by it. You can't play these violent role-playing games, these first shooter games where you're killing people in terribly realistic ways and not be affected by that. And as a parent, just like to encourage you, protect your children's minds. Don't let them play these violent video games.
And what would we do without the psychologists telling us this? A story that jumped out at me this week from Fox News. It says the U.S. Army is kicking out a decorated Green Beret after an 11-year Special Forces career after he got in trouble for shoving an Afghan police commander accused of raping a boy and beating up his mother when she reported the incident. The man who's being discharged is Sergeant First Class Charles Martland. Many of his teammates describe him as the finest soldier they've ever served alongside. He's received a ton of honors and just the top of his class, top soldier. But in 2011 in Afghanistan, they were hearing reports of the Afghans that they were training, actually raping people. He and his team leader learned that an Afghan boy was raped and his mother was beaten. They confronted this local police commander that they had trained, armed, and paid with U.S. taxpayer dollars, and the man laughed at them. He said that this is no big deal. They said it is a big deal. They physically confronted him. Martland pushed him to the ground, and this poor rapist got a bruise. One former Green Beret teammate told Fox News, "If I was a commander, I would have given him an award. They saved that kid's life." But this Afghan commander, who really I would say is lucky that he only got a bruise, he reported the incident, and the next day Martland was removed from the situation. He and his commander, his team leader, soon after he was relieved of his position, he was sent home. Now he's being discharged from the military after the whole incident has been investigated. A childhood friend who went on to play in the NFL, his name is Tim Bowman, he said, "Martland is the guy you would want him in your corner protecting our freedom." But that's not the case. And it seems like the way that the military is being run today, they're just using every tool that they can to cause honorable men to flee. I think this is the kind of thing that really crushes the morale of troops when they see men who are doing their job and putting their lives on the line being treated this way. It does a whole lot to undermine and undercut the morale of the entire military. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. I'd encourage you to go there to get a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we've talked about in the program today is in this report. And we'd like you to hear from you. If you could just send us your thoughts or your questions, you can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We're also available to follow on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. We're also on Facebook or Google Plus. Just search for the Philadelphia Trumpet there. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of football coach Don Shula. The start is what stops most people. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.